The following audio is via a Skype call.
TGIF indeed. Thank you, Eric Kramer. Hi, everybody. I'm Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
Together, we are Mance and Mitchell in your ears for the hour, and an hour of pop culture it shall be today, which is always fun every time we have George Beam on with us. So we will get to him very shortly. But first, of course, we must say hello to bad boy Benny Mathers at the board. Benny, who can also tell us, because we didn't subscribe to it, who won last night's football game? Thursday night football is a thing.
I don't know either.
Okay.
All right.
So we, in our shared ignorance, we will not know. Now, this is interesting. Maybe
we're not paying.
Yes. That's, well, George is in Virginia. Maybe somebody shouted the score to him because the Baltimore Ravens, and I was born in Baltimore, so the Ravens played the Bengals. That's a very intense rivalry. Doesn't have much to do with the Seahawks.
I have a score now if you need it.
Okay.
Cincinnati 34, Ravens 23. So since he
life sucks.
Oh boy, lot of
Suzanne, you're gonna. I'm going
points.
To go and take a sedative.
Okay.
I'm gonna go take a sedative.
Sedative. Ooh, I like
after
that.
The show.
Sedative.
After the show.
We, if you're old enough to remember all that, or if you saw it on TV because you weren't lucky enough to see it in the theater, that's just a little inside joke from Young Frankenstein. Don't act like you don't know what that means, Suzanne.
No, I didn't know that one.
There are so many, too.
Yeah.
We have George Beam with us, pop culture maven. That's how I refer to him. He has so many great things to say on many, many facets of popular entertainment. And he sent us a book this week on the double. This is fascinating stuff.
It really is. Let me give you his bio, and then let's bring him on and talk to him. George Beam has published more than 30 books, 30, 30, count them, 30, which have been translated into more than 24 languages worldwide and have appeared on numerous bestseller lists, including The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Los Angeles Times, and Publishers Weekly. A former U.S. Army major in the field artillery who served on active duty in the National Guard and in the Army Reserve. That's going to play an important role in our first segment today. George Beam and his wife live in Southeast Virginia, and I already checked with him earlier today, and he's not getting blown or rained on, as we are not either. The latest hurricane, Florence, is going right between us, not hitting either one of us. Welcome to Mance and Mitchell, George Beam. So happy to have you today.
Always good to be back. And we call it artillery, not artillery.
I would have said the same thing, though.
Oh, man. Well, okay, thank you. I do appreciate that.
No, that mispronunciation is definitely a qualification to be president. So you can, remember, it wasn't until George W. Bush said nuclear that everybody started saying, oh, I guess it's nuclear.
Artillery. I just threw another whole syllable in there.
You just misremembered.
Very
well, George,
good.
We're delighted. Anytime we watch The Big Bang Theory, you're always there in a corner of our minds. And yes, we come up with the eternal question every time you visit. What about Raj?
Not now. We'll save that.
And we will get to that. Final season about to begin here very shortly. But
I want to ask about this newest book.
And there's a whole backstory to Star Wars that I never knew. I was so happy to read that in George's book.
Well, one of the things that we were saying right before we came on air was that George Beam was saying some people saw it in the movie theater and some people didn't get to see it until it went on TV. And so I wanted to tell you, George, that I was one of those people who were in line in 1977 when Star Wars came out, because in my senior year of college, I took two related courses, and one course was astronomy with J. Allen Hynek, who was part of the Blue Book Project and very much into, UFOs.
Yeah, and there's going to be many things about that.
Simultaneously, I was taking a science fiction course where we read 18 books in 9 weeks. So I was extremely absorbed in science fiction and the universe and astronomy. And it's like I was getting a double dose of something out there. And so when Star Wars came on, I saw it in the theater and I loved it. And so I was happy to get your book, The Military Science of Star Wars. And that's what we want to talk about first today. And say what you want to say about it, and then I have a bunch of questions.
Okay. Well, basically, I wrote the book because I really feel that the whole basis of Star Wars is underlined by the word wars. And so, unfortunately, oftentimes in media, especially on TV and films, we see the military in action, but there's just not a lot of truthfulness in terms of how the military is portrayed, because after all, less than 1% of the U.S. population is currently serving on active duty. So it's the minority is the military people are really in the minority, and it's pretty much a closed universe. People are either familiar with it or they're not. And if they're not, then you get actors like Tom Cruise who are going to be jumping up and down on the flight line, you know, bumping chests, you know. And I did fly F-16s with a unit on active duty, and we went out to the flight line. Nobody was bumping chests. Nobody was high-fiving. You know, it's all kind of serious business, and it's quiet professionals at work. You just can't trust what happens on the theater, at the theaters and on TV. So I wanted to write a book that kind of cleared up some of these things in terms of something we all understood, which is Star Wars.
You're saying you want to clear things up, but it's not so technical that the layperson wouldn't enjoy it, like myself.
Well, you know, I could be very, very technical, and if I were writing for a military audience, I probably would be. But this was really for the general audience. So it's kind of like Military 101.
And I'm glad that you wrote a book just like that, because when I told you about my science fiction and my astronomy course simultaneously, when I came to the Star Wars movie, I was a young person, mm-hmm. College age, in my 20s, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed the movie. My perspective would have been different from somebody who did not take an astronomy course or a bunch of science fiction courses and read 18 books in 9 weeks. But you also would see the movie differently from the way I saw it based on your military background. Did you still enjoy it?
Well, it's two separate things. I enjoyed the movie as a movie, and I was fortunate to be able to see it with a good friend of mine who's now a former Imagineer named Tim Kirk, and we were in Kansas City, and it reminded me that even a year earlier, Kansas City hosted the Worldcon, and the Star Wars people, the marketing people, actually had a display of equipment and memorabilia, and Mark Hamill was walking around the convention, and nobody knew who he was, and everybody was saying, gee, we're not sure if this thing's going to really take off, and these were science fiction fans that should have known better, but you just really didn't get a sense from the exhibit and the PR stuff at the convention and the Mark Hamill interview that this was going to be a ground changer. This would be a big, big change in cinema history, because once that huge starship, the destroyer, comes overhead, it just seems like it never ends in the opening scene. Right then, I thought movies are never going to be the same again, and they weren't. That changed everything.
Gary talks about how he was reading UFO books when he was in grammar school rather than doing art class the way he was supposed to be. And I've had this interest from an early age. Did you also have an interest in this type of topic from an early age? Did it grab your imagination even before man landed on the moon?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's really the big question, are we alone? And it would be just a catastrophic event. It could be a good thing, it could be a bad thing, depending on your perspective, if and when we finally meet aliens. So that's the big question. That's going to, we've seen different interpretations on screen of what might happen, and all we can do is wait and see.
Wait and see, George, in an official capacity, but let me just throw this little conversational hand grenade at you. I never know whether the pin's in or out. Anyway, I'll just toss it your way. And that is by way of saying that there are plenty of people in our society, including in the scientific community, mavericks though they may be, who say you don't need to wait. That's been going on for quite a while, as a matter of fact. And we know a heck of a lot that you wouldn't put on the front page of the New York Times for fear it would be labeled fake news.
Well, you know, now there is such a thing as fake news. And it's, you know, the problem with the internet is that the information is only as good as the source. It's only as truthful as the source. And, you know, you have to have some sort of gatekeeper that's going to authenticate things and say this is true and this is not true. But with the UFOs, the question, and I agree, you know, a lot of these things can be debunked. But as Steven Spielberg points out in the introduction to a book that looked back at Close Encounters, he said, well, we can explain most of these occurrences and dismiss them. But what about the 3 or 4% we just can't explain at all? And that's really the big question, because there's an enormous amount of mystery in the what-if territory. And, you know, at the point where there's actually a close encounter of the third kind where we actually see aliens, or some other evidence that is factual and cannot be denied, then the world's going to change.
Oh, it definitely will. There's a book out, AD, After Disclosure, written by a famous ufologist, that posits the idea that there is going to be a huge, stunning, shocking realization, oh my God, we're not alone, what are the implications? And then, after a while, the dust settles, the cosmic dust in this case, and people go back to their lives, provided, of course, there's not some immediate Independence Day style
threat
involved.
Right,
yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had a chance to meet George Lucas. You actually saw
Lucky.
Him in person, and did you shake the man's hand?
I thought
that was an interesting story.
I'm just sure that George Beam ran up to him and asked for an autograph. Right, George?
Right, yeah. You know, I think celebrities are people that when they're doing their private business, they need to be left alone like everybody else. If they're on a press junket, that's different. But, you know, we were at Disney World. It was right before spring break. We got there early. We were at a cafeteria. The place was just empty. And he was with his kids. And my wife said, gee, you know, that guy looks sort of familiar. And I said, well, let me kind of walk to the side and see, you know, because he was taking a long time trying to figure out what to get his kids. I thought maybe I would motivate him, you know. I figured he would need a sense of motivation, as Darth Vader would say. And I looked around and said, geez, that's George Lucas. And my wife looked and said, yep, sure is. And he was there with his kids and feeding them for lunch. And she said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I said, gee, you know, I'm thinking maybe get an autograph or talk to him or whatnot. Then I thought about it. I said, no, it's his private time. I don't want to say anything. I want him to be with his kids and walk off and have a good time. And then I called a friend of mine who was working at Disney. And I said, was George Lucas here this weekend? And he said, yeah. He says, Lucas was working on the Star Wars ride. And, you know, I think that you have to give these very famous people their time to be alone when they're doing family-oriented things. I don't think fans have any right to go up to someone famous and interrupt them for an autograph or a quick talk session when that's not the proper venue.
I agree 100% with you, George. I've done that so many times here in the local area. We have the Seattle Seahawks, all, you know, the fans are all up in everyone's, you know, their grills, like the coach and all that. And I saw Pete Carroll, our coach, if you don't mind me jumping in real fast, at just a regular restaurant down here having some Hawaiian barbecue. It's a really great place. And I saw him. I just smiled, nodded. My friend and I, we were just talking about him. And then a big bunch of kids come in, like literally like about a dozen 15 to 18-year-olds. Just came in for you know, lunch and swarmed him, and it's like he's with his sons, you know, and his you know, family. It's like, leave him alone, and then maybe until he leaves, then ask him appropriately. Give them their space. But it's kind of lost now. I mean, but unless you speak up for yourself,
you know, this is all about manners. And
sure,
we've just seen a coarsening of manners in our society where people have forgotten that other people deserve their privacy when they're if they're a public figure and they're in a public place, and it's not work-related, they don't want to be bothered any more than you and I would.
Yep, I agree.
You know, I mean, it's like when Stephen King was in the bathroom at a hotel because he was having the runs, and somebody slipped him something under the door because they wanted his autograph.
Other than a roll of toilet paper, you're saying.
And I thought, you know, that's just not the right time.
Yeah. Maybe Stephen King didn't have a square to spare.
Right.
Well, no, and that was a horror story. He was probably out of toilet paper, you see, and didn't know what to do. But
he's probably writing another novel in there. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Toilet terror.
I know what you're both saying, and here in Sarasota, Florida, we get a lot of celebrities that come down for a little vacation, and you know, there is kind of, if you are of a certain mindset, it isn't about bombarding these people. Gary and I were having a dinner in a restaurant, and Jerry Springer came in with his grandchildren and sat down and had a meal
here downtown in a lovely Italian restaurant.
Jerry,
and Suzanne and I were talking about this passage from George Beam's book, The Military Science of Star Wars, and how he decided to leave the man alone. The celebrities are entitled to their privacy and their private moments. That's a case in point. I was trying to think of one, Suzanne, just a short while ago. Well, that's a perfect example. Jerry Springer, I mean, how many people would approach him, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, I love your show. Oh, I hate your show. Where's a chair when I need one? Anything like that. And I just decided, you know, I don't need to. I'm seeing him, but I don't need to take a selfie with Jerry Springer. I would like to ask him how you go from Northwestern University School of Law and Mayor of Cincinnati to what you do. But I just refrained because the man was having a meal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now with iPhones, you know, everybody wants a selfie. Everybody wants to say, look, I met this famous person. And it's like George R.R. Martin, now that people know what he looks like because of Game of Thrones, you know, he can't go anywhere without fans saying, gee, can I take a selfie? And he absolutely hates that. You know, if you ever see George Martin, here's something for all the listeners. If you ever see George Martin in public, you just say hi and wave or something. Don't go up to the man and say, gee, can I take a selfie? Because he might, you know, take the cell phone out of your hand and toss it or something. You know, I don't blame the guy.
I'll tell you who was a good nodder. I saw him in an airport. He was on the same flight as my mother coming into Las Vegas many, many years ago. Bill Russell. There now, Bill Russell is legendary for refusing even the most creative autograph requests. He just didn't want to get caught up in that. Never signs an autograph. So I knew better, but I just said, hey, Satch, like there, nodded, and he just gave me a deep nod, like, you know, hello. He didn't even say hello. He just nodded, but as if to say hello, and he kept on walking, and that was the end of that. I was perfectly fine with that little episode.
Yeah. Mm.
You have a little benefit, though. You're a little taller than most people, too, so he probably thought
that's true. He could see Gary.
He was still stratospheric.
He wasn't blending
in
with
everybody. He is one tall man.
Before we go to our break, George, I want to wrap this little segment up here because we have other things to talk about in the other segments coming up. But one of the things that just kind of really caught my attention in your book, The Military Science of Star Wars, was that George Lucas sold his franchise, eventually his baby, for $4 billion to Disney. $4 billion. But the first time he saw people waiting in line to see his movie, it wouldn't have ever, ever crossed his mind that he was going to end up selling that franchise for $4 billion. And I just wanted you to tell that quick story because it's one of the most fascinating I've read. When he and his wife, Marcia, went out for burgers.
Right. And before that, you know, he was with Steven Spielberg, I think, in Hawaii. And they were talking about their various projects. And George Lucas was really kind of worried because when he screened the film in private to some of his best friends, all of whom were filmmakers, nobody said a word. I mean, everybody, and then one of them came up and said, oh, gee, you know, you got a dog on your hands. And that's not the kind of thing you want to hear from your peers when you've put your time, money, and effort into something that you hope is going to work out. And so he's driving, you know, went back and driving around L.A., and he goes out and gets a burger with his then-wife, his first wife, Marcia. And they see this long line wrapped around a movie theater, and they're thinking, gee, what movie might that be? You know, it's really popular. And it turned out to be Star Wars. And, you know, you have to remember, too, for people that are old enough to remember having seen it in the theater, that back then you didn't have all of these different ways to see it. You either had to see it in the theater or you didn't. So if you wanted to see it again, you had to go back to the theater. And so Star Wars had a lot of people go back again and again and again because they wanted to experience the movie because there was no other option at the time. And it was some years later, of course, the video cassette recorder came out and they had the VCRs, the cassettes, and those were expensive. They were like $80, $100, $125. People today are used to on-demand media for pocket change. You know, the world has changed. But Lucas looked at that, and he was just enormously surprised and delighted. And, of course, you know, it became this worldwide phenomenon. And finally it got to the point where he said, you know, I've got other things I want to do. I want to build this museum. I'm thinking about my legacy. And then, you know, Disney has been spending their money and buying up major franchises. You know, before they bought Star Wars, they bought Marvel Comics. And, you know, every major entertainment thing that you can think of, with the exception of Harry Potter, they've bought up and monetized. And they've done a great job in keeping all of this alive and bringing that whole entertainment value to customers. I think that I just love what Disney does.
I do too, and they do it with the confidence of a company that has mastered the world. They've carved out their huge slice of popular entertainment imagery and identity, and as a result, they have the guts to go after the Pooh characters, for example. They're not original to Disney, but they just swept that up. I'm sure there was a dollar solution to that problem. And it's interesting to see how Disney can function as a kind of content vacuum cleaner in the world of pop culture. All of those things came together, and I guarantee you there will be photo stops where they'll have select places where you can go and, oh, I get my picture taken between R2-D2 and C-3PO, or, okay, I'll hug Chewbacca and then let's go to the buffet. Because that's what it is at Disney World and Disneyland and California Adventure, etc. We are talking to George Beam. It is our great, we got to take a break here, George. I want to give out the title of this book again. And George is a prolific author, so he will have the opportunity after our second break to do what we call the marketing piece and let you know about all the hardware that he has to offer out of his fertile brain. This book is The Military Science of Star Wars. George Beam is our guest. And we're going to get into some other stuff here on the other side of a short break. We are Manson Mitchell, and you are tuned into the home of Alternative Talk in Seattle, AM 1150.
The preceding audio was via a Skype call.
Hello, my name is Marie Manucherry. I'm an energy intuitive author and host of Where Energy and Medicine Meet. During the show, I answer callers' questions, intuitively, of course, and provide invaluable guidance. I also interview others who I believe are on the leading edge of thought. Tune in on Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 1150 a.m. in Seattle, or live wherever you are at energyintuitive.com.
When someone hears the words, "You have cancer," it's one of the darkest moments in their life. Light the Night brings light to the darkness of cancer by uniting survivors, patients, and supporters in the cause to end cancer. Friends, families, and coworkers form a community of hope, raising funds in support of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Together, we walk with lanterns held high to light the path to cures. Last year alone, the FDA approved 18 new drug therapies and treatments to treat blood cancers. The impact of LLS-supported research goes beyond blood cancer. The discoveries made in blood cancer research have led to breakthrough treatments for many cancers and other serious diseases. When we walk, cancer runs. Join the movement to end cancer today. Visit us at lightthenight.org.
Hi, this is Susan Harmon, inviting you to join me every Friday, noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time, for the Susan Harmon Hour. I'm always curious and I enjoy discussing a wide array of interesting and provocative subjects with fascinating and erudite guests. If you're looking for grounded authenticity with a twist, you'll want to join us for a fast-moving and informative hour right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back to Manson Mitchell and our guest this hour, George Beam. We love talking to George Beam. Gary calls him the pop culture maven. He's definitely a researcher with over 30 books and such a wide variety of interests. One of the things that you have been researching and studying for years, George, has been a different phenomenon, and that's the phenomenon of Stephen King. And I was wondering in this segment if you could tell us what's going on with Stephen King lately.
He's writing.
Again,
well,
huh?
You know, Stephen King is enjoying a resurgence. And what happened was that after the movie It came out, the first version, the new version, and it did like 800 million worldwide, you know, everything that King's ever done novel-wise is under option for films. But this really got people's attention because some of his other films haven't done nearly that well. And, you know, King is at the age where he can pretty much do what he wants. It's wonderful, I think, that he's working with his sons, both of whom are very accomplished writers. He's got a son named Joe Hill that has been working in the horror vein for some time. And then his son, Owen, his youngest son, collaborated with him on a book called Sleeping Beauties. More recently, he's collaborated with a publisher the publisher's name is Richard Chismar, and he's worked on some fiction with Chismar. And Chismar runs a small press publishing, you know, books for the horror market and publishing some of Stephen King's books as well. And so King has been very, you know, he continues to be very busy, very productive. And at this stage in his career and in his life, he's being taken seriously as a writer, which wasn't the case when he started out. You know, you have to remember back in the 70s when Carrie came out, people thought he was just a horror writer. And he was just in it to scare people. And now that we've seen this, basically this Stephen King library evolve with book after book, people are starting to appreciate the fact that, you know, 100 years from now, if you want to understand what it was like to live in our time, you're really going to have to pick up a Stephen King book and read it, because he covers, he has the touch and the feel of what's going on, and he can transmute that into the novel in a way that people can relate to it. Because he writes about ordinary people. He doesn't write about, you know, the rich people, the lifestyles of the rich and famous. He doesn't write about the neurotic New Yorker, you know, a la Woody Allen.
He writes about the
ordinary Joe who is faced with an extraordinary situation that he's got to deal with. And that's, to him, the nature of fear. I've done a lot of books about King. I've finished writing books about King. I'm not doing any more on King, though there's a documentary coming out in October, November that covers the King field pretty thoroughly, and they interviewed me and a bunch of other people that know of King's work. They've interviewed some of his friends. You know, so this kind of thing is getting to the point where King is getting the kind of attention and the seriousness that he didn't have when he started out.
You know, I want to ask you, George, about Stephen King as a personality, not celebrity, but as a personality. I'm going to go a swing way to the other side to just give a contrasting example. If someone were to run into Norman Mailer, who has since passed on, anybody was welcome to his opinion. And, you know, in a way, he would have been a fascinating man to meet, but you never knew with that hair trigger of his and that outsized ego what was going to happen. You could pretty much close your eyes, go through the New York City telephone book and with a finger and put it on a name, and they've probably had a fist fight with Norman Mailer. So that got to be almost comical in its dimensions. But now I'm wondering, someone like Stephen King, I certainly wouldn't expect that kind of behavior from him, but is he, in private, does he withdraw from people? Is he volatile in any way? What can you tell us about that?
Well, first, I don't really know Stephen King. I've met him a couple times in public. I didn't introduce myself. But I know a lot of people that know him very well. And, you know, King is a gentleman, first and foremost. He always talks in his interviews about how his mother raised him to be a people pleaser, and King is certainly that. I've seen him in many, many public events, and he's so good about relating to people, talking to people, making them feel special. In one case of, you know, he also has a great sense of humor. At one book signing in Bangor, a good friend of mine, a writer named Kevin Quigley, came up to him, and Kevin was just nervous as hell. And so he was talking to Stephen King, and you could see King starting to smile. And then finally King leaned forward and said, "Boo!" And Kevin, you know, screamed out and fell back. And he was literally, Kevin, we had to take him outside because he was hyperventilating, you know, put him on the side of the curb. And, you know, because he was just so overwhelmed by meeting Stephen King. Now, that was an extreme reaction because, you know, that's going to happen. But in the main, you know, people meet King and they're surprised because they think, gee, you write horror. You must be some weird man. He's not. He's from Maine. He's from blue-collar Maine. He grew up poor. And the way that he deals with the public is very, very admirable for a celebrity like King, because, you know, at his core, he's still a Maine boy, and the people in Bangor don't treat him any differently. He appreciates that. They say, "Hi, Steve," you know, walking down the street, and that's one reason why he likes to be up in Bangor. People leave him alone, or you know, they'll just talk to him like he's just one of the guys. And that's a good thing. But you know, King has never put on airs. He sometimes he clowns around. He doesn't take himself so seriously. Certainly early on when he was doing like the American Express commercial, he was clowning around with that. But he takes his work seriously, and he takes other people seriously. So you know, if you ever see him at a book signing or at a public event or whatnot, you get the impression that he's a pretty nice guy, and I think that's a fair assessment.
I think that's nicely said. Yeah, that really is. You know, it's great when you can meet celebrities, even better if you have a wonderful encounter with them. But even just to see them, as your brother saw a celebrity yesterday, that can be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. He ran into Bill Murray on a golf course, and he did get a photo. Bill Murray's very personable as well. Mm-hmm. He's approachable.
Approachable. That's the word. Yeah.
Yeah, he is very approachable.
Bill
and
Murray
said,
was
sure.
Playing the 18 holes out of nowhere. He said, "Knee." He hits it 280 yards straight down the fairway.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been kind of a latecomer to the appreciation of Stephen King because I never liked horror films, George. And when I was a very young girl, they would have all these spooky movies on at night, and I would just put my head under the covers, under the pillow. I did not want to see Frankenstein or the werewolf or any of that. I don't know why, I just never had the mental capacity for it. And then now later as an adult, I see more and more Stephen King films that I like very much. And they're not all horror, as you said. That's kind of where he got his reputation initially. But I do like it. I like his work. I like how he puts things together. And I think the reason that things are scary is exactly because he's using the common person and the common touch. And so what happens to people, you feel like, oh my gosh, that could happen to me. And so that's where the scary part comes in.
Right.
You know,
he brings the horror home.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm not as afraid now as I was when I was 7 and 8 years old. And as a matter of fact, Gary and I are now watching old horror films at night on Saturday nights with Sven Gulli. And mostly, you know, we're just laughing. There isn't any part of that scares me the way I was when I was a youngster. So it's like I'm now getting more into the horror genre than I used to be.
I used to be a long time ago.
You know, it reminds me of an anecdote of a late friend of mine who was a Maine writer, horror writer named Rick Hottola, told us how he was on a date, first date with a young woman. He was in the theater, and it was a horror film. And so, you know, it was getting to a climatic moment. And then suddenly he used his fingers and brushed across the back of her neck, and she jumped up and screamed, you know, and yelled at him, and he had a good laugh. But, you know, horror has that effect on us. It really gets our attention. It digs in deep. It activates our primal fears. And with King, what makes it so relatable is that we say, as you pointed out, it could be us. And problem, I think, is that King was pigeonholed and marketed as a horror writer. But when you start reading a lot of his work that is somewhat horror-related or suspenseful, you realize that, that in the end, what he really writes about is people. It's all about
Like Shawshank Redemption. I mean,
yes, my mother's, it must have been in some sense her favorite movie. She would watch that and watch, I took her to the theater to see that. And she couldn't stop talking about it. And I said, yep, that Stephen King's quite a writer. He wrote that? I said, yeah, Stephen King, it isn't all monsters with them, or at least not all the monsters are from Mars or whatever. Some of the monsters are human.
And the Green Mile. I mean, there were a lot of things that he wrote that were, that as far as being made into movies, were just fantastic.
That's right.
Yeah, very good.
Well, and you know, the thing is that King realizes that really the real monsters are people. People can be absolutely monstrous, and this is his way of talking about it and telling us about it. But he's a great storyteller. You know, he's a good man. We're fortunate to have him in this country, where he can produce as many books and get them out worldwide. You know, I've just got a shelf of King books, but I've really said everything I needed to say, and it's time to let the young men, the young Turks, start writing about King.
There you go.
If there was anybody currently writing, or perhaps a film director, who really intrigues you, would you consider focusing your attention on someone who is relatively young? I'm just going to say Quentin Tarantino out of the blue. I mean, if somebody wrote a thoroughgoing book, a film biography of the man and his work, I would definitely go out and buy that book.
Well, there's been several books about King and his films. You know, the films have been a mixed bag. That I think that particular book is yet to be written, and I remember King in an interview with Dr. Tony Magistrale, who chairs the English department at the University of Vermont, in an interview that they had together, King and Tony were talking about that very thing, about the fact that King was looking forward to seeing somebody take his movies seriously and write a really thorough analytical book about the movies and the themes of the movies and whatnot. That book just hasn't been written. Everything's been more popular culture, you know, with picture books and whatnot. But King has had more movies done based on his work than any other author in history. And everything he does in novel form is optioned for a movie. So
I can see why.
You know,
let's take our second. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the way he writes is you see the book unfold in your mind's eye. It's like a movie.
Oh, if you saw my cousin sitting with The Stand in a chair in the middle of his room, which was a converted garage into an expanded living room, and he had a cup of coffee going, he'd be reading until midnight, and then somehow he got to sleep with this caffeine in his system. And this giant book, you could almost get carpal tunnel holding and turning the pages of The Stand. But he told me when he read Stephen King, he was absolutely immersed in the world created for him by the author.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like when you walk into the ocean. At first, it feels kind of warm, and then you walk a little more, and it feels kind of cool, and then suddenly there's a shelf, and it just drops off, and it's deep, and that's where all the monsters are, and King's like that, too. You start reading a King book, and at first, everything seems pretty comfortable and normal, and then you go another few chapters, and things look a little dark, and then you go a few more chapters, and suddenly, you know, all hell is unleashed.
Yes. That's been my experience. Okay, we're going to take, here's the specter of another break, our last of the hour. Give us a couple of minutes, and then we're going to talk us some Big Bang Theory. Final season coming up. Is it a case of finally or aww? One way or another, that's a show that will live forever, and we'll discuss that on the other side of this break with our guest, George Beam. We are Manson Mitchell, and you are tuned in to Seattle's home of alternative talk, AM 1150.
Preceding audio was via a Skype call.
Staying connected with Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell is easy. Just go to manceandmitchell.com for the latest info on topics and guests. Friend Gary Mance and Suzanne Mitchell on their Facebook pages and like the Mance and Mitchell show page at facebook.com/manceandmitchell. If you're on Twitter, share a follow with Gary and Suzanne at Mance Mitchell. Join Gary and Suzanne Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. for an unusual show that covers everything from personal growth to the paranormal.
Here's an amazing act. Here's a tremendous act. Here's a startling act. The amazing, the thrilling, the greatest, spectacular, incredible, exciting, wonderful, world fame, most unusual novelty act.
The home of the A-Team of Alternative Talk is ManceandMitchell.com. Heard right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM or streaming live from your computer anywhere.
The following is made possible by Dad.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling all over it.
The Dad Joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
Why do you have to be careful when it's raining cats and dogs? Because you might step in a poodle.
And kids that spend more time with their dads grow up to be smarter, more successful.
Can I tell you a cat joke? Just kidding.
And with any luck, funnier adults.
Why didn't the skeleton go to the dance? Because he didn't have any body to go with.
Dad jokes rule. So take a moment to make a moment and give your kid a laugh. It's as easy as going to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
That's really funny.
I'm Gary Mance.
I'm Suzanne Mitchell.
We're a couple of baby boomers who bring you a talk radio mix of metaphysics and music, politics, and pop culture.
And you never know which celebrity will join us for an interesting conversation.
Mance and Mitchell is Boomer HQ, Friday and Saturday mornings at 10 on 1150 AM KKNW.
Your home for alternative talk in Seattle and Western Washington.
Find out the latest about your favorite shows on Alternative Talk 1150. Check out 1150kknw.com.
Welcome back to Mance and Mitchell and our guest this hour, George Beam. We always like talking to George Beam. He's all about the pop culture and the various things. George, when I was reading your bio in the beginning, I was reading that you have written over 30 books. We don't happen to have all 30. We didn't meet you when you started writing books. We have a little bit of a George Beam collection on our bookshelves. I know one of my favorites is the Steve Jobs book. I haven't finished reading The Military Science, which I will do. And Big Bang Theory, love that. But with 30 books, what are some, give some of the titles and some of the things that people might be interested in so that they can go find them either at their favorite bookstore or online?
Well, there's really two books that are in print. One is the more recently released, The Military Science of Star Wars, and that's really not for military folks per se, but for a general audience. And it's mostly having fun with Star Wars, because I obviously am a big Star Wars fan like everyone else, and I just see it from a slightly different perspective, and I share that with the readers. The other book that I'd want to point out is a book that I called, it's called The Stephen King Companion, and it's now in the third edition because every once in a while I have to update it. And it's like 500 pages, and it's got artwork by a couple of friends of mine, and it basically covers a lot of ground about his books and his life. And, you know, with this big resurgence of interest in Stephen King, I think that book is a good place to start if you're new to Stephen King, because it outlines pretty much everything and gives you some suggestions on where to go, what to read, what you need to know about Stephen King, how his life has influenced his writing, and so on. So those are the two books. You know, beyond that, a lot of the books I've done are pop culture. They have to do with Steve Jobs, or they have to do with writers like Philip Pullman, you know, or Tolkien, or Anne Rice, or what have you. You know, just popular culture in general, which is something I've been working and mining for some years. And Big Bang Theory, of course, which was a separate book.
You know, and I also just want to mention your last name is spelled B-E-A-H-M. If people would like to Google online, George Beam, B-E-A-H-M, over 30 books published in over two dozen languages on a wide variety of topics. And, you know, that's one of the things that I envy about you, George, is that you seem to go where you are drawn, where, you know, where the will takes you, where your interest takes you, and you get into these things rather deeply by what it is that interests you in the moment. Very different from being a major in the Army. And it seems like you're very free-flowing right now. You're not in any a singular track. You're just kind of all over with whatever it is that catches your attention. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah, I think there's a big dichotomy between the two. People would have a lot of presuppositions and assumptions of what you're going to be like as a person, you know, if you've been a field-grade military officer. I don't really see that. I think, you know, I've always been first and foremost a writer. And it reminds me of the Big Bang Theory. You know, I saw the first show. And for me, it was really important and special and personal because I came from that subculture long before we were celebrating nerds. And I came from a subculture of fandom from science fiction and comics where, you know, where women were clearly in the minority. And it was male, you know, the field was male-dominated in terms of writers. And you go to conventions, and it's mostly all men. And it reminded me of that first convention where they had fans many years ago. I think it was in the 30s or 40s. And it was all young men in their teens and early 20s, you know, who were very socially awkward. And now, of course, you know, fandom has gotten, if you go to one of the big shows now, they've become big business and they're big entertainment things. But with Big Bang, you know, the characters rang so true to me because I knew that kind of enormous social awkwardness that was there, even though you thought, well, you know, I think I'm smart, I think I'm bright, you know, what's wrong with me? You know, what's wrong with me that I can't relate to people and can't talk to people and whatnot? And I think that kind of cultural angst was captured so well in the Big Bang. And I think as long as it focused on that and the conflicts that they had with people, I think the show really, really excelled. I think now it's a very mature show. You're getting
yes.
you're getting toward the end, and you know you're seeing less and less of Sheldon and more of the other characters, which to me is just not as interesting because you know it's like with Sheldon when he finally decided or Jim Parsons decided that you know he's done it enough, and he wants to move on. When he decided to pull the plug, that's it. The show ends. And that shows how important Jim Parsons is to the show, because you really don't have a Big Bang Theory show without Jim Parsons.
Right, he's
what I would call the nucleus of the show.
Right.
Yes, that's fair.
This is like the 14th year for something like that.
I lost track.
Yeah, it quite a few years, 10,
yeah.
12, 14. It's
yeah.
somewhere in there. But, you know,
somewhere over 10, yeah.
And we've been watching them, especially in reruns, repeatedly to the point where Gary and I know the dialogue that's coming
right.
up. And it's mm-hmm. funny because the things that we find so humorous initially, they're still funny. I mean, we'll laugh at the same joke over and over again. But when you talk about the show being mature, I can definitely see that because in the beginning, I think it was much more outrageous. And now
yes.
it seems to be less outrageous and more settled. But also the characters are getting older. So, you know, when they first came on, they were supposed to be, I guess, in their 20s.
Right.
And even if, you know, technically they
yes.
were a little older. But now they're like in their 40s. Well, you can't be the same goof.
I look at Stuart, the comic books writer, and go, he's almost ready to sign up for Medicare.
Right.
And he's a wonderful character. You know, there's I think of the great scene. I still laugh uproariously every time the episode is on where Penny makes Sheldon sing Soft Kitty to her and they sing it as a round. And you can hear the audience roaring when they complete it. That's the family feeling. That's the intimacy of the audience with the show and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a classic show. It's going to run forever in reruns. You know, I just watch almost no TV now, unless it's educational or you know, Channel 15 or what have you, or maybe the news a little bit. But The Big Bang is something that I religiously turn to. And, you know, it's because I just like the interplay, the humor. It's had, in the last few years, I think it's just been a little off here and there. where episodes just didn't work for me or they worked really well. But the thing is, they've had a great run. It's a great show. I'll be sad to see it go. But I think it's time for them to move on. I think the actors all feel that way, or at least Jim Parsons does. You know, it's not about the money. I mean, Jim Parsons could make millions. He makes $1 million a show. But at this point, he doesn't need the money. But he says, hey, you know, I'm not 20 anymore. I'm not 30
right.
anymore. And
yep.
There's other priorities in life. It's not all about life. It's not all about money.
Right. He had that role, supporting role in Hidden Figures. He's also on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. You know, the man has his own life, and fortunately, he has the visibility where he can, you know. And I do, and I actually want to see Jim Parsons in different roles. I don't want
so
to see him forever as Sheldon. You know, because
he's
so talented.
Nobody on TV that I can think of can take complex lines and be in a situation where he's asked mockingly to repeat it and repeat it again. And no matter how many takes it took, he does this with these lengthy monologues in his Prescriptions for Science and Humanity. I go, I just don't know any other actor of his generation who could pull that off consistently.
Well, it's amazing. You know, it's just his ability to memorize these things and rattle them off flawlessly is remarkable to watch.
Especially when he's a non-scientist to begin with.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's you know, they've got a real scientist on the show. You know, Amy Farrah Fowler. In real right. life, she's got a doctorate. So in science. So they've got the credentials there. But Jim Parsons really convinces me that he's a physicist.
Yes. Yeah, we're going to miss it. We're going to enjoy the last season, and we're still wondering what they're going to do with Raj.
We've got a minute. Raj, I mean, are they finally going to marry him off? Is there some deep, dark secret? I sure hope not, because you know very well, George, there are many ways to screw up a finale, and I know that Chuck Lorre and crew are determined not to make that mistake with this gem of a show.
Well, you know, they've got enough time now they've got a whole season to wrap up a lot of loose ends. And they don't have that many to wrap up, but they need to have some sort of resolution with Raj. I think Raj was a miscalculation from the beginning in that they really didn't know what to do with him. And so he's been floundering around for, you know, over 10 seasons. And the character really hasn't changed that much, in my opinion, whereas the other characters have gone through dramatic changes. You know, when you have Sheldon getting married, I mean, that's a huge, huge change.
Seismic, yes.
Yeah. George, thank you so much for joining us today. We love talking about Star Wars and
Always.
Stephen King and Big Bang Theory, and we look forward to having you back again.
Well, this is always fun, and I'm surprised the hour has gone by so quickly. But, you know, when you talk about popular culture, there's always something to talk about.
Yep, and Absolutely. We'll talk again about it. Thank you for being with us.
It was fun.
All right.
Coming up next, Christine Upchurch, followed by
Susan Harmon
and her erudite guest.
And thank you, Benny, for your work today.
You're
great
welcome,
as always.
And I have a parting gift for you guys. Since it's honor of Gary's birthday a couple days ago and for George's birthday coming up. So this is what we're going to leave.
The preceding audio was via a Skype call.